Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Now, some people look at this and talk about shallow materialism, but that's absolutely the wrong way to look at it. This is abundance, which is exactly what we want our economic system to provide. The second reason that the new machine age is such great news is that once the androids start doing jobs, we don't have to do them anymore, and we get freed up from drudgery and toil. So the green shoots are out there.
Extract 1.
But what's true about a single product or service or industry has never been true about the economy as a whole. Many of the industries in which we now work, health and medicine, finance and insurance, electronics and computing, were tiny or barely existed a century ago. Many of the products that we spend a lot of our money on, air conditioners, sport utility vehicles, computers, and mobile devices were unattainably expensive or just hadn't been invented a century ago. As automation frees our time, increases the scope of what is possible, we invent new products, new ideas, new services that command our attention, occupy our time, and spur consumption.
Extract 2.
Now, technological unemployment, if it does happen, in a strange way, will be a symptom of that success. We'll have solved one problem, how to make the pie bigger, but replaced it with another, how to make sure that everyone gets a slice. As other economists have noted, solving this problem won't be easy. Today, for most people, their job is their seat at the economic dinner table, and in a world with less work or even without work, it won't be clear how they get their slice. There's a great deal of discussion, for instance, about various forms of universal basic income as one possible approach, and there's trials underway in the United States and in Finland and in Kenya. And this is the collective challenge that's right in front of us, to figure out how this material prosperity generated by our economic system can be enjoyed by everyone in a world in which our traditional mechanism for slicing up the pie, the work that people do, withers away and perhaps disappears.
Extract 3.
Now, does that mean there's nothing to worry about? Automation and employment, robots and jobs, it'll all take care of itself? No. That is not my argument. Automation creates wealth by allowing us to do more work in less time. There's no economic law that says that we will use that wealth well, and that is worth worrying about.
Extract 4.
I believe that the jobs of the future will come from the minds of people who today we call analysts and specialists, but only if we give them the freedom and protection that they need to grow into becoming explorers and inventors. If we really want to robot-proof our jobs, we as leaders need to get out of the mindset of telling people what to do, instead, and start asking them what problems they're inspired to solve and what talents they want to bring to work. Because when you can bring your Saturday self to work on Wednesdays, you'll look forward to Mondays more. And those feelings that we have about Mondays are part of what makes us human.
Extract 5.
You may think some of these things are frivolous. Extreme yoga, adventure tourism, Pokemon Go, and I might agree with you. But people desire these things and they're willing to work hard for them. The average worker in 2015 wanting to attain the average living standard in 1915 could do so by working just 17 weeks a year, one-third of the time. But most people don't choose to do that. They are willing to work hard to harvest the technological bounty that is available to them. Material abundance has never eliminated perceived scarcity. In the words of economist Thorsten Veblen, invention is the mother of necessity.
Extract 6.
Simultaneously, employment is shrinking in many middle education, middle wage, middle class jobs like blue collar production and operative positions and white collar clerical and sales position. The challenge that this phenomenon creates, what economists call employment polarization, is that it knocks out rungs in the economic ladder, shrinks the size of the middle class, and threatens to make us a more stratified society. On the one hand, a set of highly paid, highly educated professionals doing interesting work. On the other, a large number of citizens in low-paid jobs whose primary responsibility is to see to the comfort and health of the affluent. But it's equally foolish to say that our fates are sealed. That's not decided by the machines. It's not even decided by the market. It's decided by us and by our institutions.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Now, some people look at this and talk about shallow materialism, but that's absolutely the wrong way to look at it. This is abundance, which is exactly what we want our economic system to provide. The second reason that the new machine age is such great news is that once the androids start doing jobs, we don't have to do them anymore, and we get freed up from drudgery and toil. So the green shoots are out there.
Extract 1.
But what's true about a single product or service or industry has never been true about the economy as a whole. Many of the industries in which we now work, health and medicine, finance and insurance, electronics and computing, were tiny or barely existed a century ago. Many of the products that we spend a lot of our money on Air conditioners, sport utility vehicles, computers and mobile devices were unattainably expensive or just hadn't been invented a century ago. As automation frees our time, increases the scope of what is possible, we invent new products, new ideas, new services that command our attention, occupy our time, and spur consumption.
Extract 2.
Now, technological unemployment, if it does happen, in a strange way will be a symptom of that success. We'll have solved one problem, how to make the pie bigger, but replaced it with another, how to make sure that everyone gets a slice. As other economists have noted, solving this problem won't be easy. Today, for most people, their job is their seat at the economic dinner table. And in a world with less work or even without work, it won't be clear how they get their slice. There's a great deal of discussion, for instance, about various forms of universal basic income as one possible approach. And there's trials underway in the United States and in Finland and in Kenya. And this is the collective challenge that's right in front of us, to figure out how this material prosperity generated by our economic system can be enjoyed by everyone in a world in which our traditional mechanism for slicing up the pie, the work that people do, withers away and perhaps disappears.
Extract 3.
Now, does that mean there's nothing to worry about? Automation and employment, robots and jobs, it'll all take care of itself? No, that is not my argument. Automation creates wealth by allowing us to do more work in less time. There's no economic law that says that we will use that wealth well, and that is worth worrying about.
Extract 4.
I believe that the jobs of the future will come from the minds of people who today we call analysts and specialists, but only if we give them the freedom and protection that they need to grow into becoming explorers and inventors. If we really want to robot-proof our jobs, we as leaders need to get out of the mindset of telling people what to do, instead, and start asking them what problems they're inspired to solve and what talents they want to bring to work. Because when you can bring your Saturday self to work on Wednesdays, you'll look forward to Mondays more. And those feelings that we have about Mondays are part of what makes us human.
Extract 5.
You may think some of these things are frivolous. Extreme yoga, adventure tourism, Pokemon Go, and I might agree with you. But people desire these things, and they're willing to work hard for them. The average worker in 2015, wanting to attain the average living standard in 1915, could do so by working just 17 weeks a year, one-third of the time. But most people don't choose to do that. They are willing to work hard to harvest the technological bounty that is available to them. Material abundance has never eliminated perceived scarcity. In the words of economist Thorsten Veblen, invention is the mother of necessity.
Extract 6.
Simultaneously, employment is shrinking in many middle education, middle wage, middle class jobs like blue collar production and operative positions and white collar clerical and sales positions. The challenge that this phenomenon creates, what economists call employment polarization, is that it knocks out rungs in the economic ladder, shrinks the size of the middle class, and threatens to make us a more stratified society. On the one hand, a set of highly paid, highly educated professionals doing interesting work. On the other, a large number of citizens in low-paid jobs whose primary responsibility is to see to the comfort and health of the affluent. But it's equally foolish to say that our fates are sealed. That's not decided by the machines. It's not even decided by the market. It's decided by us and by our institutions.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Today with Claire Byrne.
Yeah, Philip, there's a number of reasons for that. The main reason is the health insurance legislation. So we have this thing called community rating in this country, which basically means everybody pays the same, regardless of your age or your gender, which is good, by the way, because in a lot of other jurisdictions, as you get older, you're simply priced out of health insurance completely. But we also have a thing called minimum benefits. And minimum benefits means that every plan that they launch has to have a certain minimum standard of cover. So that's why people will see things like alcoholism, psychiatric benefits, maternity benefits, and so forth. And it's not because they think we need to have those benefits, especially when you get older, obviously, but it's because they want to make sure that every plan has that minimum standard. Because if they didn't do that, like let's take psychiatric, every plan in Ireland has to have 100 days cover. In the UK, most plans cover you for one day. So anybody who has an underlying psychiatric condition, their health insurance is like gold dust because that covers 100 days in the private hospitals. So that's why people will see things on their plans that maybe aren't relevant to them. So what I would say, pretty much echo what Charlie has said there, anybody who's reviewing their cover, if you see stuff on your plans that isn't relevant to you, skip over it. Don't bother phoning up and asking them, why can't you take that offer? I actually think the insurance company should maybe hide some of those benefits because it just irritates people when they see things on the plans that aren't relevant. But they're there for a specific legislative reason. It doesn't really impact on your premium. And I would say to people, just look at the benefits that are particular to yourselves and don't worry about those other benefits.
It's been a very hard year for a lot of people, very hard 2 years for a lot of people, Charlie. Do we know how many are opting out of health cover?
Not a huge number, really, Philip. We've had the opposite. Despite the hit to incomes for a lot of people, despite the restrictions, the numbers are up again this year. We're up back up to records. Really? Since, yeah, we're up 2.3 million people. 48% of the population have health insurance. That's up about 57,000 in the year up to September, according to the Health Insurance Authority, the regulator. So, you know, people are very anxious to have health insurance. I think COVID has probably helped that because people have seen waiting lists and they've seen long queues to get into the public system. So they decide, we better have health insurance. Okay. The other thing is companies buying cover. And then, you know, what they call lifetime community rating, where if you get to 35 and you haven't got health insurance, well, if you decide to buy it from then on, you're going to get penalised. That's been a huge factor for the last few years in people deciding it's crunch time now. Do I need to take out health insurance now or it's going to cost me too much if I leave it into my 40s?
Dermot, possibly an impossible question for you to answer, but Can you give us some sort of an indicative price of what people should be paying for health insurance so that, and I'm not going to hold you to it, just a broad brushstroke of a figure so that people have an idea of whether they're getting good value or whether they're being fleeced?
Yeah, so the best way to look at this, an entry-level plan is going to cost you €500 for the year. Is that good cover? No, it just covers public hospitals. The next level above that is what we call a mid-level plan. They cost between €900 and €1,050 per adult. They are a step above that because they cover all public and all private hospitals. So every public hospital in the country and private hospitals like the Hermitage Clinic or the Galway Clinic or the Beacon, I would always advise people, if you can at all, try and get to at least a mid-level plan. The next level above that is what we call a corporate plan. And corporate plans are going to cost you roughly €1,300 to €1,400 per adult. I would always say to people, don't get confused by the term corporate. Anybody can join these plans. They just are the best plans on the market because they're designed specifically for the corporate sector. And they will give you money back on all your routine expenses. So even though they cost more, you'll get 50% back on your GP, your physiotherapy, consultants fees and so on. And that's really like €1,400 gets everybody an excellent standard of cover. Anything above that, as an advisor, I would be looking, well, what's the reason why you're going higher than that? Do you want a private room? Do you want to get 75% back on certain expenses and so forth? So that's why, like, I can tell you now, the amount of people, Philip, who are paying €2,800, I would say to anybody who's come home for Christmas and they're with their parents right now, your parents are on the old plans, the old plan B, plan B options, and they're paying €2,740. You need to sit down with mum and dad before you go home or before you go back to whatever, back to work, and do a review for them, because they're overpaying in some cases by €500 to €1,000 per adult, and they're afraid to change. And they're the people, I think the HIA survey showed that, I think like some people over 60 are probably overpaying by 35 to 40% on average for their health insurance.
Because there is no reward, and this comes in as a question, 51551 on the text. There's no reward, Charlie, is there, for loyalty to your insurer?
No. Yeah, I mean, you can switch to another plan, you know, as long as your existing condition is covered. If you know, be careful that if you're going up to a better plan, that some existing condition is covered. But you know, if you've served your time, if you get credit for being in the system, so you can move around plans, you can move around providers. You know, okay. If you're not.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Today with Clever.
Yeah, Philip, there's a number of reasons for that. The main reason is the health insurance legislation. So we have this thing called community rating in this country, which basically means everybody pays the same, regardless of your age or your gender, which is good, by the way, because in a lot of other jurisdictions, as you get older, you're simply priced out of health insurance completely. But we also have a thing called minimum benefits. And minimum benefits means that every plan that they launch has to have a certain minimum standard of cover. So that's why people will see things like alcoholism, psychiatric benefits, maternity benefits and so forth. And it's not because they think we need to have those benefits, especially when you get older, obviously, but it's because they want to make sure that every plan has that minimum standard. Because if they didn't do that, like let's take psychiatric, every plan in Ireland has to have 100 days cover. In the UK, most plans cover you for one day. So anybody who has an underlying psychiatric condition, their health insurance is like gold dust, because that covers 100 days in the private hospitals. So that's why people will see things on their plans that maybe aren't relevant to them. So what I would say, pretty much echo what Charlie has said there, anybody who's reviewing their cover, if you see stuff on your plans that isn't relevant to you, skip over it. Don't bother phoning up and asking them, why can't you take that offer? I actually think the insurance company should maybe hide some of those benefits, because it just irritates people when they see things on the plans that aren't relevant. But they're there for a specific legislative reason. It doesn't really impact on your premium. And I would say to people, just look at the benefits that are particular to yourselves and don't worry about those other benefits.
It's been a very hard year for a lot of people, very hard 2 years for a lot of people, Charlie. Do we know how many are opting out of health cover?
Not a huge number, really, Philip. We've had the opposite. Despite the hit to incomes for a lot of people, despite the restrictions, the numbers are up again this year. We're up back up to records. Really? Since, yeah, we're up 2.3 million people. 48% of the population have health insurance. That's up about 57,000 in the year up to September, according to the Health Insurance Authority, the regulator. So, you know, people are very anxious to have health insurance. I think COVID has probably helped that, because people have seen waiting lists and they've seen long queues to get into the public system. So they decide, we better have health insurance. Okay. The other thing is companies buying cover. And then, you know, what they call lifetime community rating, where if you get to 35 and you haven't got health insurance, well, if you decide to buy it from then on, you're going to get penalised. That's been a huge factor for the last few years in people deciding it's crunch time now. Do I need to take out health insurance now, or it's going to cost me too much if I leave it into my 40s?
Dermot, possibly an impossible question for you to answer, but can you give us some sort of an indicative price of what people should be paying for health insurance, so that, and I'm not going to hold you to it, just a broad brushstroke of a figure so that people have an idea of whether they're getting good value or whether they're being fleeced?
Yeah, so the best way to look at this, an entry-level plan is going to cost you €500 for the year. Is that good cover? No, it just covers public hospitals. The next level above that is what we call a mid-level plan. They cost between €900 and €1,050 per adult. They are a step above that because they cover all public and all private hospitals. So every public hospital in the country and private hospitals like the Hermitage Clinic or the Galway Clinic or the Beacon. I would always advise people, if you can at all, try and get to at least a mid-level plan. The next level above that is what we call a corporate plan. And corporate plans are going to cost you roughly €1,300 to €1,400 per adult. I would always say to people, don't get confused by the term corporate. Anybody can join these plans. They just are the best plans on the market because they're designed specifically for the corporate sector. And they will give you money back on all your routine expenses. So even though they cost more, you'll get 50% back on your GP, your physiotherapy, consultants fees and so on. And that's really like €1,400 gets everybody an excellent standard of cover. Anything above that, as an advisor, I would be looking, well, what's the reason why you're going higher than that? Do you want a private room? Do you want to get 75% back on certain expenses and so forth? So that's why, like, I can tell you now, the amount of people, Philip, who are paying €2,800, I would say to anybody who's come home for Christmas and they're with their parents right now, your parents are on the old plans, the old plan B, plan B options, and they're paying €2,740. You need to sit down with mum and dad before you go home or before you go back to whatever, back to work, and do a review for them, because they're overpaying in some cases by €500 to €1,000 per adult, and they're afraid to change. And they're the people, I think the HIA survey showed that, I think like some people over 60 are probably overpaying by 35 to 40% on average for their health insurance.
Because there is no reward, and this comes in as a question, 51551 in the text. There's no reward, Charlie, is there, for loyalty to your insurer?
No. Yeah, I mean, you can switch to another plan, you know, as long as your existing condition is covered. If you know, be careful that if you're going up to a better plan, that some existing condition is covered. But you know, if you've served your time, if you get credit for being in the system, so you can move around plans, you can move around providers. You know, you're not.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Really kind of realizing great things for humanity. And the money is a byproduct, really, which I think speaks a lot to what you were saying earlier about how he was the one who fronted the money for Tesla and then saw Tesla become what it is now, a very valuable company. But really, what will satisfy Elon Musk about it is it's a company that's really changing the world.
All that's very laudable, but the work practices, the work culture, the union busting, and the treatment of employees in some Tesla facilities does not set a good example, does it, Adrian?
No, it doesn't. So in October, Tesla was found to have been negligent in terms of on racial issues, and one guy got a $130 million settlement there. There have been endless stories from within Tesla and SpaceX, but mostly Tesla, about, you know, Musk being a bit of a slave driver in terms of working people too hard and driving them to the edge. There's a very, very controversial work culture in that company. As he sees it, this is the price you have to pay to, you know, to push technology and to push progress. But from, if you or I were working there, Well, I certainly don't think I'd last very long there.
That's a good admission. I missed a trick there, perhaps, Finn, by not once Adrian had suggested that it's white guys who like him because he builds things. Why do you like him? Where do you? What do you admire in him?
I think there's. It's not necessarily an admiration, but a kind of backlash to received narratives about him. You know, the common narrative that you gave at the beginning, you know, he's a, you know, not a particularly nice guy. He's kind of irresponsible. He doesn't really deserve what he has. And I kind of wanted, when I was writing this piece about him, I kind of wanted to challenge that narrative and actually think about what Elon Musk has done and the impact he has had on the world, which is, as I've said, undeniable with Tesla and SpaceX. And that he's a kind of he's different. He's odd. He's a renegade. He doesn't fit into easy categories. But the world would be better off for more people like him making these huge kind of I mean, not to be too glib about it, but these huge steps for humanity. We need people like Elon Musk. We don't have to like people like Elon Musk. You know, we don't even have to be obsessed with Elon Musk or care that much about Elon Musk. But I was just so interested in how he was such a polarizing figure. You know, people love him for building rockets and people hate him for a litany of other reasons. And I think there's just some space in the middle.
Push back against this narrative then, both of you, if you will. The SpaceX success is one that's just a question of timing. It came at a point where NASA was starting to look at outsourcing, doing the donkey work of getting satellites and astronauts up into space so that they could concentrate their resources on getting to Mars or whatever else. Adrian?
Yeah, but some of that is true. But two observations. First of all, when he was looking to send a rocket into space, he was on his way back from Russia. He had had unproductive discussions with a couple of Russian companies who have a lot of experience there. He didn't want
somebody allegedly spat in his face when he tried to buy an intercontinental ballistic missile off them.
One of the Russian engineers. But on the plane on the way back, Ashley Vance has a brilliant biography on him, and it's described on the plane the way back. He was just jotting on a notepad, and he turned to his colleague and said, look, I think we can do this ourselves. Also, do bear in mind, look at the rockets that he has built. Okay, he's sending a rocket up, a reusable rocket that can land vertically, like some sort of 1950s or 1960s science fiction program. That kind of progress was years off, you know, from anyone else. So yes, the commercial conditions were there for him to take advantage of that once he had, you know, organized that technology. But he has actually built it. It is actually a pretty incredible step change in terms of what we can now do with rockets.
What do you think, Finn? Not just a question of fortunate timing, but that this is quite a brilliant rocket engineer.
Yeah, of course. Of course, the technology is incredible and, again, revolutionary. I also think there's something. Elon Musk is representing a kind of bigger shift in how we conceive of space travel and how we conceive of kind of billionaires' obligations to kind of existential crises about the world. You know, space travel used to be within the remit of superpowers, and it used to be something that presidents kind of you know, championed and tried to get the people to, you know, come along and support. Almost a source of national pride. And now, increasingly, we're seeing a lot of the space exploration shift towards private companies. You know, Jeff Bezos was recently in space as well. Elon Musk hasn't gone. But and I think that's a very interesting broader societal shift that Elon Musk is really at the forefront of.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Really kind of realizing great things for humanity. And the money is a byproduct, really, which I think speaks a lot to what you were saying earlier about how he was the one who fronted the money for Tesla and then saw Tesla become what it is now, a very valuable company. But really, what will satisfy Elon Musk about it is it's a company that's really changing the world.
All that's very laudable, but the work practices, the work culture, the union busting, and the treatment of employees in some Tesla facilities does not set a good example, does it, Adrian?
No, it doesn't. So in October, Tesla was found to have been negligent in terms of on racial issues. And one guy got a $130 million settlement there. There have been endless stories from within Tesla and SpaceX, but mostly Tesla, about, you know, Musk being a bit of a slave driver in terms of working people too hard in driving them to the edge. There's a very, very controversial work culture in that company. As he sees it, this is the price you have to pay to, you know, to push technology and to push progress. But from, if you or I were working there, Well, I certainly don't think I'd last very long there.
That's a good admission. I missed a trick there, perhaps, Finn, by not once Adrian had suggested that it's white guys who like him because he builds things. Why do you like him? Where do you, what do you admire in him?
I think there's, it's not necessarily an admiration, but a kind of backlash to received narratives about him. You know, the common narrative that you gave at the beginning, you know, he's a, you know, not a particularly nice guy. He's kind of irresponsible. He doesn't really deserve what he has. And I kind of wanted, when I was writing this piece about him, I kind of wanted to challenge that narrative and actually think about what Elon Musk has done and the impact he has had on the world, which is, as I've said, undeniable with Tesla and SpaceX. And that he's a kind of, he's different. He's odd. He's a renegade. He doesn't fit into easy categories. But the world would be better off for more people like him making these huge kind of, I mean, not to be too glib about it, but these huge steps for humanity. We need people like Elon Musk. We don't have to like people like Elon Musk. You know, we don't even have to be obsessed with Elon Musk or care that much about Elon Musk. But I was just so interested in how he was such a polarizing figure. You know, people love him for building rockets and people hate him for a litany of other reasons. And I think there's just some space in the middle.
Push back against this narrative then, both of you, if you will. The SpaceX success is one that's just a question of timing. It came at a point where NASA was starting to look at outsourcing, doing the donkey work of getting satellites and astronauts up into space so that they could concentrate their resources on getting to Mars or whatever else. Adrian?
Yeah, but some of that is true. But two observations. First of all, when he was looking to send a rocket into space, he was on his way back from Russia. He had had unproductive discussions with a couple of Russian companies who have a lot of experience there. He didn't want
somebody allegedly spat in his face when he tried to buy an intercontinental ballistic missile off them.
One of the Russian engineers. But on the plane on the way back, Ashley Vance has a brilliant biography on him, and it's described on the plane the way back. He was just jotting on a notepad, and he turned to his colleague and said, look, I think we can do this ourselves. Also, do bear in mind, look at the rockets that he has built. Okay, he's sending a rocket up, a reusable rocket that can land vertically, like some sort of 1950s or 1960s science fiction program. That kind of progress was years off, you know, from anyone else. So yes, the commercial conditions were there for him to take advantage of that once he had, you know, organized that technology. But he has actually built it. It is actually a pretty incredible step change in terms of what we can now do with rockets.
What do you think, Finn? Not just a question of fortunate timing, but that this is quite a brilliant rocket engineer.
Yeah, of course, the technology is incredible and, again, revolutionary. I also think there's something. Elon Musk is representing a kind of bigger shift in how we conceive of space travel and how we conceive of kind of billionaires' obligations to kind of existential crises about the world. You know, space travel used to be within the remit of superpowers, and it used to be something that presidents kind of you know, championed and tried to get the people to, you know, come along and support. Almost a source of national pride. And now increasingly we're seeing a lot of the space exploration shift towards private companies. You know, Jeff Bezos was recently in space as well. Elon Musk hasn't gone, but and I think that's a very interesting broader societal shift that Elon Musk is really at the forefront of.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.